The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to Short Circuit, a weekly podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeal. I'm your host, John Ross, joined today by Clark Neely and Evan Burnick of IJ's Center for Judicial Engagement. If you like what you hear, be sure to check out the email newsletter for a weekly roundup of circuit court cases. Subscribe at ij.org/shortcircuit. This week on the show, school choice in Louisiana, a fanciful false statement, and an anti-competitive grocer. Clark?
So the first case comes out of the Fifth Circuit. It's called Brumfield versus a bunch of people in Louisiana. It involves a 40-year-old desegregation order. Back in the day, Louisiana schools were officially segregated. That was the subject of a court challenge. And there's actually a case, the Brumfield case, that has been going on for 40 years or more than 40 years, but there's been a desegregation order in place for 40 years. And what happened was that the U.S. Department of Justice tried to use the ongoing litigation and the existence both of a 1975 desegregation order and a 1985 consent decree to basically derail a voucher program that the state of Louisiana created after Hurricane Katrina to provide or to expand educational opportunities for children in Louisiana. The Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice stepped in really bizarrely. I mean, there was really nothing about the program that in any way connected to the pre-existing desegregation litigation, but essentially just tried to use that existing court case to derail a school choice program.
Right. So just to clarify, the original desegregation order had to do with funding of racially discriminatory private schools. This happened decades ago.
Public funding of racially discriminatory.
Public funding of racially discriminatory private
schools. Which some
states
engaged in order to provide parents the ability to take their children out of the newly integrated public schools. That's what was going on back then.
Right. But there's no claim now that the voucher program is either being directed to public private schools that engage in racial discrimination. There's no allegation of constitutional infirmity with the voucher program itself. The DOJ is basically trying to use a decades-old desegregation order to micromanage and derail a voucher program that's helping thousands of kids get a quality education.
Yeah, tell us about the voucher program, Clark.
So the program is called Student Scholarships for Educational Excellence. It was created in 2012, and it is available to children who are whose families are poor or who attend low-performing public schools. And about 85% of the eligible students are, in fact, Black. And so the idea is that, as with all school choice programs, is to provide parents for greater opportunities for educational choice and a life raft for students who are attending poor public schools to go to better schools. That obviously is a very politically charged issue. And what DOJ did here, and the Fifth Circuit accurately described this as extremely disingenuous, DOJ argued that all it was trying to do was seek further discovery in the existing Brumfield desegregation litigation. It wasn't a it wasn't a direct attack on this program. It wasn't even a collateral attack on the program. They were just seeking additional information about the way that the voucher program would operate, et cetera. That was an extraordinarily disingenuous position for DOJ to take for several reasons, but including, A, this was not simply a discovery request. It was not an attempt to find out relevant information or information relevant to the ongoing desegregation lawsuit. And second, this was not simply an attempt to acquire additional information. This was rather clearly an attempt to discourage and ultimately prevent the state of Louisiana from operating a voucher program, and I would say for rather obviously, transparently political reasons. And the Fifth Circuit slapped DOJ down, and they got bench slapped, and they deserve to get bench slapped.
Yeah, tell us more about the Fifth Circuit decision.
Yeah, so the Fifth Circuit basically accused the DOJ of going on a fishing expedition, a very costly fishing expedition. DOJ argued that the voucher program might potentially frustrate desegregation of public school districts in other pending cases. Now, that concern, whatever the merits of it, first of all, there is no reliable evidence of it. Second of all, it's completely removed from the scope of the initial order. And Judge Jones actually draws a very good analogy here. It's as if decades ago, a prison was found to be violating the Eighth Amendment in terms of the care that it provided to prisoners. And then decades later, the prison is accused of having too many rats running around its facilities, and the DOJ then requires the prison to provide reams and reams of information about its rat population.
When in fact, the first case was about medical care.
Right, exactly. And even though the state, the prison has remediated the initial concern about medical care. Again, this is the DOJ's attempt for transparently political reasons to draw upon the authority of an order that has nothing to do with its current concerns in order to continue to monitor and ultimately derail a school choice program that's helping thousands.
We would be remiss if we didn't point out that Louisiana has gone from one of the, frankly, worst states for public education to one of the most exciting states because there is so much parental choice now. There are charter schools. There's this voucher program. So Louisiana responded to this terrible natural disaster, Hurricane Katrina, by taking the opportunity to take a fresh look at the way that it delivers public education and by injecting a tremendous amount of parental choice, which is exactly where our public education system needs to be headed. America is a great country in large measure because of our commitment to innovation. The one area where we see very little of that is public education, and a state like Louisiana that is helping lead the way towards educational innovation. The last thing they need is for a politicized Department of Justice to be throwing barriers in the way of that. Fortunately, the Fifth Circuit was engaged and prevented that from happening.
Okay, let's move on to the next case. Evan.
So this case deals with a fire that consumed 10 apartments and several restaurants. The investigation into that fire and specifically the police's investigation of one business owner for arson. This man, Firas Rahman, is interviewed by the police in connection with the fire. They get him to sign a consent form that allows the police to search his business for the origins and causes of the fire. They do so. They later come to the conclusion that the fire started somewhere else. They later develop suspicion that the fire was actually deliberately caused, that it was an act of arson, and they return to Rahman's business.
Where
they have already ruled out the possibility of the fire starting there to search for evidence of what is going to develop into a criminal investigation.
So why is that a problem, Clark?
Well, it's because without the consent, the Fourth Amendment protects the owner of this business from not having the police come and investigate it without a warrant from a court. And it underscores a really important point, and that is that consent, when the law enforcement seeks a citizen's consent to do a search or for other law enforcement-related purposes, that's a contract. That is a contract between the government and the individual. And if what the government really wanted in this case was for this individual to relinquish his Fourth Amendment rights across the board, that is precisely what they should have asked for. And if the citizen is unwilling to give that, then they don't get it. And it is important to determine what are precisely the contours of the consent that was given. In this case, it certainly did not include an open-ended investigation into all possibilities about whether he was, in fact, the individual who set this fire, which later a jury determined he was not, or at least they acquitted him of the crime for which he was charged, namely arson.
Right. The cops in this case essentially try to do an end around the Fourth Amendment. They get his consent for a very limited purpose. They later develop suspicion that he may be guilty of a crime. They, instead of seeking his consent specific to their new what is now becoming a criminal investigation, they try to rely upon his initial consent. And the court does not allow them to take advantage of somebody who's legally unsophisticated in that way.
Okay, so he's acquitted for arson, but he is convicted on something else. Tell us about that, Evan.
Yeah, so he's convicted of making a false statement to the police, and he's convicted of making a false statement because he told the police that he had a laptop containing business records in his basement. They searched his basement. They didn't find a laptop, and they did find a laptop without business records at his home when they searched it. Putting two and two together, they said that he had lied about the location of his laptop. The response to that, of course, is is that he said that he had a laptop with business records in his basement. The laptop in his apartment did not have one. His girlfriend actually testified that he had two laptops, one in his basement, one in his apartment. But on the basis of the fact that he said he had a laptop in his basement, they didn't find it, and they found one at his apartment, they convicted him.
So, you know, Evan said that they put two and two together, but it sounds more like what they did was put two and three together, but still came up with four because that was the predetermined conclusion that they wanted to come up with.
That would be a better way of putting it.
I think the takeaway from this case is this. Courts should not be overly sentimental. In fact, they shouldn't be sentimental at all about whether the government will or will not honor its commitments, whether there are or are not incentives to promise one thing but then do another thing. The fact of the matter is that there are strong incentives for government investigators, just as there are strong incentives for people who don't work outside the government, to interpret an agreement in the light most favorable to them. And again, courts shouldn't be sentimental about this. Look at what actually happened. Determine whether the scope of the consent that was given, if the government is acting outside of the scope of that consent, then make them go to court and get a warrant, which is what the Fourth Amendment requires, and fortunately what the Seventh Circuit required in this case as well.
Right. And the alternative, of course, is that they could have been honest with the guy. They could have said, okay, we're expanding the scope of our investigation. Do you consent to this additional search for this additional purpose? They didn't do that, and they didn't get a warrant either, and the court rightly rebuked what they did.
Okay, let's move on to the next case. Clark.
Well, this is an absolutely fascinating case out of the Third Circuit, and there's a lot going on in the case, so we'll have to distill it down to the essence. And the essence is this. There's a realty company that is working with Wegmans Supermarket to open a new Wegmans outside of Morrisville, New Jersey. There is an existing supermarket called ShopRite that appears to be concerned about the new competition that it will be facing. And what this existing shopping center does is it invokes and involves itself in every conceivable phase of the approval process. So the Wegmans grocery store has to jump through a bunch of regulatory hoops before it can open a new store. And these include things like getting a flood hazard area permit, a wetlands permit, a street permit, and there's various other hoops they have to jump through. At every single turn, the existing grocery store inserts itself into the process, raises concerns, throws up roadblocks, and the question is whether that conduct can or cannot subject the existing grocery store to antitrust liability under the theory that it is attempting to thwart competition by invoking these regulatory processes and involving itself in these processes with the deliberate attempt to make sure the Wegmans can't open a new store and compete with them.
And what did the Third Circuit say, Evan?
Yeah, the court made an earnest effort to determine whether ShopRite was actually seeking to further genuine regulatory concerns or just engaging in sham litigation and engaging in the regulatory process to make it impossible for somebody to compete with them.
And this implicates a fascinating doctrine of antitrust law called Norr-Pennington. Essentially, boils down to this. We want citizens and companies and others to have the ability to involve themselves in the political process without threat of antitrust liability, provided they're doing so for sort of genuinely public-spirited reasons. But the question becomes, when you've got this incredibly elaborate, onerous regulatory scheme, which frankly we have in almost every setting involving businesses in this country, there are certainly opportunities for existing businesses who don't want the competition, the new competition, to manipulate that regulatory process in a way that doesn't look public-spirited at all, and in fact looks like a deliberate attempt to thwart competition. And that is what the Norr-Pennington doctrine tries to get at. On the one hand, you're immune if you're trying to invoke or involve yourself in a political process for public-spirited ends, but you may be liable under antitrust law if you're just nakedly doing it to suppress competition. That's the issue in this case.
So how did the court reach the conclusion that this is a sham?
Well, the court looked at the pattern of behavior that ShopRite had engaged in, their complete lack of success of ever establishing a viable claim or establishing a regulatory error on the part of the realty company. And said,
the realty company representing the Wegmans.
Realty company representing the Wegmans, and came to the conclusion that if Norr-Pennington has any meaning and we can distinguish between sham litigation efforts and genuinely public-spirited litigation efforts, this falls into the sham category.
So this is really interesting, right? Because at the Institute for Justice, we see private entities manipulating the political process to try to suppress competition all the time. Now, it happens that in most IJ cases, that manipulation of the political process occurs at the front end. In other words, for example, lobbying for interior design laws or lobbying for a law that requires a license to be a florist. It is 100% clear that the purpose of those laws is nothing more than the suppression of competition. And it is ludicrous to suppose that the state of Florida really thinks it's trying to protect the public from the completely non-existent dangers of unlicensed interior design, or that Louisiana is trying to do the same thing with floristry. So the question is it possible that courts are able to make this inquiry in the antitrust setting when the regulatory process is involved, but completely unable to make the inquiry when it's, for example, sham lobbying activity?
Right, and that makes absolutely no sense. What you occasionally hear from courts in cases involving patently protectionist government regulations is that courts can't possibly get inside legislators' head and figure out what was really going on, whether they were serving public-spirited ends or serving completely anti-competitive ends. In this very case, we see courts making that distinction in the context of private entities. They can distinguish between sham litigation efforts and genuinely public-spirited efforts to ensure that people are complying with relevant regulations. If they can do it in this case, they should be able to do it when the government is the one that's acting anti-competitively.
So one thing that I think this case really underscores is how preposterous it is to suppose that the normal political mechanisms that we have, in other words, things other than judicial review, will be sufficient to prevent government regulatory schemes from being either created or manipulated for the sole purpose of suppressing competition or otherwise interfering with other people's constitutional rights, in this case, the constitutional right to open a business. And the idea, again, that the sort of the normal political process will provide a sufficient check or a sufficient protection, it's unnecessary for courts to be engaged and to step in when someone is clearly either having their constitutional rights violated by an anti-competitive actions, or when they're being subjected to the anti-competitive behavior of a competitor that violates antitrust law. Courts should be engaged in both settings, not just one.
So tell us about the actual check in this case. You have a Wegmans and the realty company. They sue the ShopRite. Is that what happened?
Yes, that's actually what happened. They sued them under the Sherman Antitrust Act.
So it's to be clear, it's the Wegmans grocery store and the realty company that is representing Wegmans trying to help them get a new store open. And it's the realty company that sues the existing grocery store that is engaged in all this arguably sham petitioning. It's important to note this case went up on a motion to dismiss. So we don't know what the ultimate outcome of the case will be. But the question in the case was, did they sufficiently allege not only culpable antitrust activity, but also, did they sufficiently allege the facts that they would need to avoid Norr-Pennington immunity that would normally attach to a citizen or a company's involving itself in the regulatory process?
Right. And it's important to understand what happens if the court does not engage in this case. This business does not open. The contract is probably not going to go through. You will actually not get a competitor as a consequence.
Okay, that concludes the show. We had fun, and we hope you did too. For more cutting-edge constitutional commentary, follow Clark and Evan on Twitter. Their handles are @conlawlawyer and @EvanBurnick. Until next time, this is John Ross from the Institute for Justice, impelling you to get engaged.